drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. He describes himself as an introvert trapped in an extrovert's body. Once the cameras stop rolling and the guests have gone, he seeks solitude. And yet we know Andrew Denton as one of Australia's best interviewers who draws out the best in people. How does he do it? Andrew Denton is back on our TV screens with the second season of Interview, a very aptly named show, I've got to say. Just tell people what it really is. Andrew Denton, welcome.
Patricia, thank you. And thanks for noticing. In this time-poor world, we just wanted to come up with a title so people didn't have to waste any time working out what the show's about.
I think that is very kind of you, because why come up with elaborate titles when you've got such a descriptive word? Now, Andrew, there is a real skill to what you do, because you really have to listen to get the best out of someone. What's your process ahead of an interview?
Absorb as much as I can of the person I'm going to speak to, so I'll watch interviews with them. I'll obviously, if they're performers, I'll look at what they've done. I'll listen. Particularly, I like to listen to radio interviews or podcasts, because you can often hear a person better when you're not looking at them. I have a brilliant team of producers who put together a serious research brief, and I really try and absorb that person's life story, but also to get a sense of what seems to me to make them tick. And that sets a roadmap for how I want to go about the interview.
With the world being increasingly faster these days, and what I mean really is the 24-hour news cycle, it's intense. Twitter, like the whole world, I feel like in 5 minutes I feel behind. I can't keep up. How do you factor your approach into that? Do you think about that? Because, you know, when you approach an interviewee, of course, so much happens so quickly. What is your kind of approach to the fact that so much happens?
That's an interesting question. I would go further and say it's not just a 24/7 news cycle. It's a 60-60 24/7 news cycle, in that every second something is out there. From the point of view of the conversations I have, which are long, I don't really tend to think much of that news cycle. Often what we're talking about are universal things rather than things that are topical. So what I'm looking for always is an honest connection with the guest. And I am aware, I mean, I've certainly seen since coming back to television with Interview that the landscape has changed, and it's harder to get guests now, because I think people are wary about what happens once an interview has gone out and, you know, what that cycle of social media might mean. But in the actual space of the conversation, really all that is kind of irrelevant. I'm just trying to make a connection with who I'm talking to, and pushing everything else to one side.
That's really fascinating what you just said about it's harder to get people over the line. Is that really noticeable, that people are more reluctant now?
Yeah, and I think there's other things in play. Many people manage their communications now through social media. So the kind of thing I'm doing, which is really old-fashioned in a way, we describe it as slow cooking in a fast food world, you know, to have a long conversation with someone. But people are managing that through social media. And also there's been the rise of podcasting, of which I'm a consumer and a fan, and there's a lot of great conversations happening in that space too. So when I was doing Enough Rope back at the ABC many years ago now, it wasn't the only thing of its kind, but it was near to singular in the landscape. And so it was never easy, but it was easier to get guests.
What's the difference between doing an interview in a podcast or radio, you know what I mean, an audio format like this one, to television? Do you find that there is a different kind of reluctance from guests?
Oh, there's just a different atmosphere to it, not just for the guests, but for me too. There's an intimacy to radio, which is even more so in podcasting. I made a podcast series about 4 years ago about the enormously cheery subject of voluntary assisted dying. And you know, when I made it, I thought, well, I don't know who's going to listen to this. I still couldn't tell you how many people have listened to it, but it's had more impact than anything I've ever done on television. And so I think there's an intimacy, not just to the conversation in podcasting and radio, but I think people hear it differently as well. They're making a commitment. Often, for example, with your show, people are listening in cars. So it's a quieter space than when you're watching television.
What do you prefer?
Oh, as a practitioner?
Yeah.
Podcasting over radio, radio over television.
And
television over coal mining.
Okay. At least it's won over something. That's interesting. So the lack of intimacy, the fact that you're on show in a different way on television, makes the interview, well, kind of not as special in some ways.
No, it's not. You can still get amazing moments of intimacy, and when they happen, and that's what we're seeking, they're very powerful. But there's a nervous energy that goes with performing in front of an audience. It's not just about my performance as the host and interviewer, but I feel a responsibility for the guest. Often I'm talking about things which are difficult. They're emotionally challenging, and I have a responsibility to take care of my guest, and so that they're not left feeling vulnerable in a way which is not healthy for them.
How do you deal with topics that are off limits? And I ask this, obviously, I'm an interviewer as well, so I, you know, you get requests, oh, don't go near this. I personally don't agree to them, but I know that there are often those requests. How do you handle that?
It doesn't come up that often, but I'll give you two examples of many years ago, I interviewed Chris Martin from Coldplay, and his people, and it's often the people rather than the person themselves, said, yeah, it's fine, but he won't talk about his wife or his child. And we said, look, in the course of a long interview, it would seem strange not to address that. So we would like to, but if he doesn't want to do the interview, we'll understand. And he did accept, and we did talk a little bit about his wife and his child, as much as we felt appropriate, and it was all fine. Last week on interview, I spoke with Angry Anderson and his daughter Roxanne, and as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, Angry's youngest boy was brutally murdered last year, and this was the first time Angry had spoken publicly about it, and he put two requests around the interview. One is that we didn't actually mention his son by name during the interview, and the other was that we didn't go into any of the details of what had happened. And there was a long series of conversations leading up to Angry being interviewed, and we understood those were reasonable requests, not just for Angry and his daughter Roxanne, who joined him, but for other members of the family too, all of whom are trying to process their grief.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. Andrew Denton is my guest in tonight's Drawing Room, and we're talking about Interview, which is back on our screens. How about being interviewed, like now? Do you like being interviewed?
I'm okay with it. But it's less interesting to me for the obvious reason that I know most of my own answers. So I'm not going to surprise myself all that often. At least I hope I'm not, because something's gone terribly wrong. No, it's always more interesting to talk to somebody else. And it's most interesting to talk to somebody else and start to discover something you hadn't realised.
So you don't mind it, but you know what you're going to say. Well, that's sort of disturbing to me. So so far, you've just said everything you planned to say, right? This is going badly for me.
Well, I haven't sat here and scripted it, but you know what I mean. I know me. I know me, and I know my own. Can I use the word bullshit?
Yeah,
if I can't.
Can.
Yeah, so I know my own bullshit too, and I'm less likely to surprise myself.
After Enough Rope wrapped up in 2008, what did you do?
Well, many things. I still ran the television production company and made that. So immediately I turned around into probably the project of which I'm most proud of my career, which was a not much watched show called Hungry Beast on the ABC. And that was taking 19 complete newcomers to the media and building a show from scratch around them. And the point about that was, you know, the ABC's role, one of its key roles to my view, has always been to bring new talent through. And it was to open a door to a whole lot of people who were new to the media, who had ability, and show them the ropes. And I'm pleased to say that almost all of those people now have flourishing media careers, several of them at the ABC. So I did that immediately. I made other shows as well, including the fondly remembered Brandling. And but then I sold out of that about 4 years later, and I did a lot of travelling. I really was burnt out, and I went to a lot of the world's wild places, the Arctic and the Antarctic and the Kimberley and the Larapinta Trail and Great Ocean Road. And that was wonderful for my soul. I learned to scuba dive, which, considering I can't swim, was a big challenge for me. And I went scuba diving in New Guinea, which was hugely exciting.
Can I just say,
exciting.
I have to pick you up on that, because I can't swim either. So firstly, I want to hug you, because you rarely meet other people who can't swim in this context. But I find the idea of learning how to scuba dive petrifying, because I can't swim, and the whole concept of that just does my head in. How did you get your head around that?
Well, I kind of figured I'm less likely to drown when I've got oxygen tanks strapped to me. And look, I actually really did enjoy it. I had the odd moment, but I suspect many people do, where I was, you know, 20 metres under the water and I thought, my God, that's a lot of water on top of me right now. But and so you have that brief moment of panic and then you move through it. It is so beautiful. I thoroughly recommend it.
So what got you back in the chair after all these years? I mean, you said, you know, we talked about it, you did enough rope for a long time and now you're back. What made you want to do it again?
Well, I'd sat out for about 5 years and we've all seen the world change dramatically in the last decade. And I would say that the single most consistent force for change has been the rise of social media and how that has superheated the public conversation. And what I saw and what we continue to see, and Christchurch, one of many, but particularly showed this, is there is such venom now in our public conversation and such partisanship that I wondered if it was possible to have a different kind of a conversation, which was a bit gentler, a bit more empathetic, which was actually speaking to values and ways of leading your life rather than ideologies and ways other people should be leading their lives. And so I was curious to see if that could be done again. And I realised that I'm 59 now, and I realised that if I left it too many more years, you know, the television industry, the free-to-air industry is a distressed industry. It's changing in the face of digital media. And I thought probably the boat would have sailed. So it seemed the right time.
It's a distressed industry. It's a good way to describe it. Does that distress you?
Well, if you're talking about somebody that's producing and hosting a TV show to some degree, but I accept that it's a distressed industry. It's, you know, when we came back last year and people commented, oh, the audience is only half the size of what it used to be in Enough Rope, brackets, therefore it's failing. I thought, well, everybody's audience is half the size of what it used to be 10 years ago. Does it distress me as a consumer? No, the rise of digital media is now the shape of the world. So it's a bit like saying, you know, I'm not very happy with gravity. Get over it.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about, you know, social media and you saying you wanted a gentler place. This is a gentler kind of format. Are you on social media?
Only on Instagram and only to a very, very carefully curated group of people I know. So I proudly have, I think, about 104 followers.
Why have you decided not to go into those strange places where some of us, you know, spend too much time?
It's interesting. I had an instinct way back when I was making Hungry Beast. So these were 19 people all under the age of 30, and we particularly wanted them to come and make the show because we felt that the quote-unquote digital generation at that time didn't have a sufficient voice at the ABC. So we wanted to hear their take on the world, and our instruction to them was, tell us something we don't know. They used to say to me, oh, you should get on Twitter, or, you know, this is perfect for you. And I just had this absolute instinct that I didn't want the noise. I didn't want the noise of Twitter. I didn't want the noise of Facebook. I could see all the benefits. I'm not one of these people that goes, oh, it's terrible. I can see so many benefits, and I've seen them many times with many people. But to me, I am a great believer in one of the most important creative states, not just professionally but as a human being, is to daydream and to allow things to freewheel and connect. I find, you know, I observed the behaviour of people close to me on social media who were so fixated on the amount of response they were getting, how many retweets or likes or dislikes, that I felt that this was not really a healthy creative state. So I, right from the start, decided I'm not going to do this. And some of my favourite words in the world are decline and unfriend and things. I think they're brilliant words and I use them freely.
Is there anyone you're desperate to interview that you haven't been able to nail down yet?
Oh, certainly top of that list is Rupert Murdoch. You know, the most powerful non-elected person, certainly in Western civilization. An undeniably extraordinary life and career. Yes, I would love to sit down and talk at length with Rupert Murdoch. I don't think he has the same enthusiasm.
I'm guessing you've tried.
Yes.
A lot.
Well, there's a point at which you realise, yeah, there's probably no point knocking on that door anymore. But it is, I've just made a mental note, must send a message to Roop.
Yeah, that's the journalistic way, isn't it? Must. Yes. Must keep pursuing that. Because sometimes if you do pursue something enough, you randomly get a yes, don't you? Has that happened before to you?
Yeah, actually the most surprising example of that. So when I started Enough Rope, I actually did sit down and wrote out my list of the 10 people I'd most like to interview. And amazingly, almost all of them ended up on the show. And two of those quite different ends of the scale, who I never expected to be sitting opposite, were Bill Clinton and Alan Bond.
Wow. How did you get them over the line?
They each had books.
Yeah.
But in the case of Bill Clinton, it was that thing you dream of happening.
Exclusively reveals, yeah. Yeah.
Where the publisher rang us up and said, would you come to England to interview Bill Clinton? It's like, yeah, I think I would.
How about Donald Trump?
You know what? I've thought about that a lot. And I think enormously difficult. And I want to preface this by saying I would rather this was not construed as a reactive liberal left-wing remark. I think it is difficult to dispute that the man is a pathological liar. I mean, quite literally, he has said one thing in public one day and the next day denied that he said it. So very, very hard to interview. And you couldn't start with this question because there's no point starting with a question that would shut the interview down. But I think I would have to ask him, why is lying so important to you?
That's a good question. How about our political leaders? We're in a political campaign.
Mm.
Do you want to interview them?
Well, that's very interesting. We actually did put out an invitation to both leaders and their wives to sit down because, and I did this with a great deal of trepidation because I knew that any interview with Bill Shorten and Scott Morrison, which was as this was designed to be, not about policy, but about what kind of a person are you? What are your morals? How do you conduct your lives? Will be viewed by at least half the audience as an unspeakably soft thing to do and we'd be kicked to death. Nonetheless, we sent out the invitation and it was really interesting. The Prime Minister and his wife accepted and Bill Shorten accepted, but his wife didn't. So we didn't do it.
How fascinating.
Yes, I've never met Chloe before, but it's there's something in there. Should they make it to the lodge, I'll be fascinated to see who she is.
Yeah, me too. Andrew Denton, I'm glad I've got some of these things out of you. It's been absolutely a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks for coming on.
Patricia, thank you.